Maine Calling's Your Vote 2020 coverage is brought to you by MEMIC, AARP of Maine, and the law offices of Joe Bornstein.
Independent candidate for U.S. Senate, Lisa Savage. There are four candidates on the ballot for U.S. Senate in Maine: Republican Susan Collins, Democrat Sarah Gideon, Green Independent Lisa Savage, and Independent Max Lynn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This week on Maine Calling, I will be joined by Maine Public's senior political reporter, Mal Leary, to interview all four of the candidates. And today we talk with Lisa Savage. Savage is a former public school teacher and longtime peace activist and environmental advocate. Among her top priorities, Savage wants to decrease spending on the military to expand renewable power. She supports Medicare for All single-payer health insurance, and she wants public higher education to be free. What are your questions for independent Lisa Savage? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling, and I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. I'm joined by Maine Public senior political correspondent, Mal Leary. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2020 conversation with Lisa Savage. She is an independent and one of four Maine candidates for U.S. Senate. We invite you to submit a comment or question to any of the candidates by emailing talk@mainepublic.org, tweeting at Maine Calling, or posting a comment to our Facebook page. And as I'm sure you've noticed, Maine Calling is now broadcasting at 11 a.m. Be sure and tune in each morning at 11. And don't forget, you can still hear our broadcasts, our rebroadcasts at 7 p.m. One other programming note. For the rest of this week, we are going to be interviewing the other candidates for U.S. Senate. Next week, we speak with the candidates running for Maine's two congressional district seats. We will not be taking live calls during those interviews, but we encourage you to leave us a voicemail in advance of these programs. That phone number, 207-370-3487. Tell us your first name, where you live, and what you want to ask. Again, 207-370-3487. And I'm going to start with an email question from an audience member. Welcome to you, Lisa Savage. This question is from Bernie in Acton. It is unfortunately a long shot that a third party candidate can win this election, regardless of how well spoken, level headed, and intelligent she may be. You've encouraged people to vote you as their first choice when casting their ballot. Will you please explain why they would not be wasting their ballot in doing so?
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you, Bernie, for that question. Well, we have ranked choice voting, and Mainers worked hard to get it. And now we've used it, of course, in past elections. I live in the 2nd District. It was used in the Jared Golden election, where he defeated Bruce Poliquin using ranked choice voting. So I think that's a good reference point for the power of this particular voting system. Sometimes it makes more sense if we think of it as instant runoff voting. And the reason I say that is, if any candidate in a race gets a majority of the votes, then the election is over. The last Senate election, Angus King won a majority of the votes and he was done. But in this election, people can rank me first, indicate that they believe in the progressive programs that I've been promoting. The top of the list would be Medicare for All, single-payer universal health care during a pandemic. Many, many people in Maine are underinsured or not insured at all. And I support an improved form of Medicare for All that would cover dental and mental health and many things that aren't covered for everyone who needs health care. Also, a Green New Deal to respond to the climate emergency like it's an emergency. So people indicating with a first choice ranking my name show that they want those kind of programs and they support that kind of progressive agenda. Then if they go on to vote blue number two, as we're urging our supporters to do, there's really no effect on whether or not the incumbent, Senator Susan Collins, gets a majority of votes in the first round. People who rank me first are very unlikely to rank Susan Collins second. People who rank Democrat Sarah Gideon first are very unlikely to rank Susan Collins second. So there really is no danger of a spoiler. It's one of the big reasons I think that Maine voters have consistently supported ranked choice voting. in two referenda that passed by strong majorities, and the Maine legislature has seen fit to enact the laws to give us this choice in the U.S. Senate race and also in the presidential race this year.
Lisa, would you be running if it weren't for the ranked choice ballot?
Honestly, Jennifer, probably not. I've just retired from teaching school for 25 years. I would love to spend some more time with my grandchildren. I've been very active as a political organizer around militarism and climate for many years. But electoral, you know, my only elected office that I've held before was that I was elected vice president and chief negotiator of the teachers union, the local bargaining unit, and the school district where I worked for several years in a row and went through that process. But this is my first foray into electoral politics. I'm sure that I will remain politically engaged whether I win the election or not. But I think that there is actually a decent chance that we could win with ranked choice voting.
Now let's turn to our senior political correspondent, Mal Leary. Mal?
Jennifer, let's start off with a follow-up to this ranked choice voting question, because Colby College has done some polling in this area, asking the very question that Lisa was putting forth. And what they found was a very interesting phenomenon, that there really was no pattern to where the second choice votes went. They were helter-skelter. In fact, several of the ranked choice folks who voted first for Lisa then ended up voting for Max Lynn. So Lisa, do you really think this is going to be that helpful to you?
Well, I'm not sure about the people that ranked Max Lynn second. I'm guessing they saw independent after both our names and thought, I like independent candidates. I can't tell you, Mal, how many people out in the field have told me as soon as they hear that I'm an independent candidate, they want my palm card and they say, we need more of that. So it's an interesting discussion about that particular second ranking. I'm not sure if people that rank me first, I'm urging them to rank Sarah Gideon second because I would like to see the incumbent unseated, but I'm not sure exactly what they will do. I do know that Colby poll has shown that I poll strongest among young voters. So ages 18 to 34 is the age group that I do the best with. That is a traditionally underserved sector in polling, tends to be underrepresented in polls, and also tends not to vote. We're hoping that in a year where the president is up for reelection and so much is at stake that young voter turnout will be higher than it typically is, but remains to be seen.
Lisa, let's go on to some of the major issues that Maine people are confronting. Congress has provided billions of dollars to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. It's also invested billions in new testing for the disease, buying personal protective devices for medical providers, first responders. Where do you see the need for additional federal spending to address the disease?
Thanks for that question, Mal. Well, as a just retired school teacher, I would say in our schools, many school buildings I've worked in Maine have been old with poor air quality conditions, poor ventilation. And I think that that's something that is very expensive to address. Many school districts struggle with, should we close that building? Should we renovate the air exchange program? You know, what should we do about that? Even the need for additional school buses, more distancing on school buses, more distancing in learning spaces, I think, and additional staff could be addressed by funding help for our schools. Really, the state and municipalities have not received any significant relief funds under the pandemic, and those entities often are the ones that support our most vulnerable populations. In addition to providing a lot of funding for schools, they support the people that live in Maine that need the most support from the government. So I think continuing to fully fund things like, Maine Care for Children and other programs that the state and that our cities run that, people turn to, housing vouchers. It was all very well to say at the beginning of the pandemic, everyone just stay home, but that's a particularly cruel thing to hear when you are unhoused and have been struggling to house yourself or yourself and your family. So I also believe rent relief, eviction freezes, and that sort of thing coming from Congress has been helpful and should continue.
Now, the economic impact of COVID-19 continues to hurt families businesses both here at Bayard and across the country. Congress provided literally trillions of dollars through the Paycheck Protection Program for businesses, bonus unemployment benefits, billions to the states for a variety of programs that economists all say has lessened the impact on the economy. What specifically do you see as needed in this next round of federal aid?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Mel. The Paycheck Protection Act, I think, did some good things, but hearing from small business owners, I once owned a small family business and operated it for 7 years, a successful business in Skowhegan before I became a school teacher, so I have some sense of how hard it is to be a small business owner in Maine. It looks like the Paycheck Protection Act did help small businesses, but it also helped a lot of large, rather wealthy businesses that probably did not need a great deal of help. It could be argued, yes, but they kept people on the payroll. What I heard small business owners saying about it is, payroll is the least of our problems. If we can't make our overhead, we can't keep people on payroll. It doesn't matter how much payroll relief you give us. So I think a more comprehensive relief for business owners that they can use for, you know, pay the mortgage or keep the lights on would also be important. And really, I think closing those loopholes where very, very wealthy corporations got relief under bills that were intended to, you know, help smaller businesses and, you know, individuals stay employed.
All right.
So what specifically do you think's needed in addition?
Well, I think again,
just changes in particular.
I think that helping businesses with their overhead costs, so if they have a lease, help them stay in their building, help them make their utility payments, you know, help them with the many, perhaps subsidize some of their unemployment taxes or state payroll taxes. I know there's been a huge loss in revenue for the state and for municipalities because the economy kind of tanked in the pandemic and hasn't fully recovered. Maine had a decent turnout here toward the end of tourist season. There's certainly been a lot more tourists in Maine than I expected to see. So some of those businesses have gotten some help from that. But I think that any help that the federal government could extend to keep businesses able to pay the rent, make their lease payment or their mortgage payment, whatever it is, able to keep their utility bills paid, able to meet their obligations to the you know, public entities that get revenue from them, those would all be a good use of relief funds.
Lisa, your platform centers on climate change and specifically reducing carbon emissions dramatically. You call for the U.S. to be emissions neutral by 2030. By incentivizing solar and offshore wind farms, creating more public transit, and banning fracking. Is this timeline realistic, given some of the technologies your plan depends on are still in the development phase? It will be less than 9 years in January when you're sworn in.
Thanks for that question, Jennifer. I do think it's realistic. I think I was a history major, and I've seen not only this country but other countries turn on a dime when the will was there and the resources were there to confront a great challenge. People love to use the metaphor of responding in wartime. I'm an anti-war person, so I'm not super fond of that metaphor, but it's certainly true that at the beginning of World War II, the U.S. was able to change over its industrial capacity to producing wartime goods very, very quickly under the Defense Production Act and using federal funding. We have seen an example of this happen even during the pandemic here in Maine. Many listeners are probably aware that I've been part of a group for many years organizing and calling for the conversion of General Dynamics Bath Iron Works Shipyard to producing something that would respond to or mitigate the effects of climate crisis. During the pandemic, the company that was making nasal swabs for testing the original COVID-19 tests that had a specialized kind of swab was being manufactured in Maine, but they weren't producing enough of them for the pandemic. So when they were approached to say, hey, could you double production, they said, well, we'd need more machines. And according to what I read in the press, Senator Angus King reached out to Bath Ironworks and said, hey, could you make these machines for Puritan Medical? We've got defense production money right here. And of course, BIW said, yes, we can. And they pivoted, and within 4, maybe 5 weeks, they had delivered the machines. So I think, you know, there has to be the will in place to do it, but it's amazing what can be done with federal contracts and, you know, a sense of urgency that this is an emergency. I think people, young people, look at my generation and say, what part of emergency do you guys not understand? You know, the whole West Coast has been on fire all through the late summer and still is. And, you know, the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than any other body of the world's oceans, and it's affecting our fisheries. There's been an extreme drought in Maine this summer that's really affected our farmers. We're in the midst of a real climate crisis. So responding to it with a sense of urgency and it's a crisis and putting our resources in that direction, I certainly think that we can achieve these goals.
Mal?
The most important foreign policy question a U.S. senator, congressman, will ever vote on is, when should the United States use military forces? What are your criteria for going to war, and do you see a global trouble spot where that might soon apply?
Well, this is a question that's near and dear to my heart. I do, I have seen the U.S. go to war on some pretty shaky grounds, including, fabricated evidence of weapons of mass destruction, or including targeting a country like Afghanistan that has not attacked the United States, yet we still are at war there 19 years later. As for what criteria I would consider for a future war, that's a really hard hypothetical to answer. I do know that almost all wars are, in U.S. history at least, are rationalized as saying, oh, there are innocent people suffering and we must go in and save them. I don't see that the application of military force has been very effective at improving the quality of people's lives or their security and safety. It's using the wrong instrument for that purpose. I have seen the decline of diplomacy as a very important, especially when you're a world power like the United States, very important tool in the toolbox. There are many ways that the U.S. can use, bring pressure through diplomatic channels to address security issues elsewhere in the world. I don't think that turning the State Department into another arm of the U.S. military has been a great idea. And I also want to recognize that economic sanctions, which the U.S. has against, I think, more than 20 countries right now, the list grows daily, but the last time I looked, it was at about 18 different countries. Economic sanctions are a form of warfare. They may not be dropping bombs on people, but they do cause many, many deaths. Madeleine Albright acknowledged years ago how many children had died in Iraq under economic sanctions before the shock and awe attacks, saying it was a price worth paying. I'm not sure the U.S. people agree that that's a price worth paying, and I think that we should consider all the ways in which the U.S., projects force against other countries and really rethink those in a modern world where, you know, the biggest security threats we're facing are international and we're all in it together, the pandemic and climate crisis. Those no national borders. We need more cooperation than, belligerence and hostilities at this point.
Lisa, I'd like to follow up on this part of the conversation, but we do need to take a break. So when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about foreign policy, and we'll also have more of your questions with U.S. Senate candidate Lisa Savage. This is a Your Vote 2020 conversation. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from MEMIC. With a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy. AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots, aarp.org/mainevotes. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine.
Humans went from living in small tribes to massive societies. How do you get everyone to follow the rules in the days before police departments and traffic cameras?
Those who will not live by the law shall die by the law.
How notions of an angry, punishing God helped humans survive. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
And that's coming up tonight at 10 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Join Maine Public, the Nature Conservancy in Maine, the Maine Education Association, and the Maine Mathematics and Science Alliance for a special lecture series around our collective relationship with the natural world around us. We're presenting free online Zoom lectures inspired by the PBS documentary The Age of Nature, exploring how humans have shaped and affected Maine's rivers, forests, and ocean. Our next lecture, Maine's Ocean, How Science is Powering Resilience for Coastal Ecosystems and Communities Flow, the Ripple Effect of Restoring the Nature of Rivers in Maine, is this Thursday at noon, and the featured speaker is Dr. Heather M. Leslie, Director, Darling Marine Center at the University of Maine. Please register now for this lecture at mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks with Maine Public Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. We're talking with Lisa Savage, who is a candidate for U.S. Senate, about why she's running and her stance on the issues that are most important to Mainers. Share your comments or questions by sending a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post on Twitter @MaineCalling, or comment on our Facebook page. And a reminder, we will not be taking live calls during this program. I want to follow up, Lisa, on what we were talking about before the break. You were talking about your opposition to the use of economic sanctions as a foreign policy tool, and you talked about diplomacy. So I want to know how you believe the U.S. should respond when faced with a global crisis such as a future genocide.
Well, again, answering hypotheticals is a little bit tricky because you don't know what the actual, context is and the background and what kind of relationship we have with whoever's perpetrating the genocide and so forth. The ongoing genocide of Native people here on this continent is probably the one we should be focused on solving. It's still very, very dangerous to be an indigenous girl or woman in North America, and it's still we're still having many indigenous people trying to migrate on foot from Central America because it's so dangerous there, based on years of having U.S. Foreign intervention. Sometimes it's corporations, sometimes it's actually U.S. sponsored militias, and so forth. I think we have problems to solve here at home, and I'm not, as a history student, I taught the genocide of the Holocaust and other genocides many times as an elective to high school students. I do think it's important to educate our young people about genocides. It's alarming to people of my generation when we hear what I think we saw a statistic recently that 50% of young people didn't know what the Holocaust referred to. But, we do need to look to our own backyard, I would say, before we go around the planet solving everyone else's problems.
Well, let me ask you this, not in terms of genocide, but another foreign policy question that's very upfront right now. What should the U.S. do in the face of further Chinese aggression in the South China Sea, Hong Kong, or Taiwan? Ignore it?
Well, the U.S. is certainly not ignoring it. The U.S. has been building up its military installations in the South China Sea for years now. I've been part of a group that supported the island of Jeju in South Korea, which has been resisting destroying a World Heritage Site, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, to put in a deep water port so that U.S. warships can be stationed very close to China in the South China Sea. One of the things that we tend to forget, I think, with our 800 military bases around the planet is what would we tolerate other countries putting a military base either on our land or right off our land and, in the oceans right off our shores? I don't believe we would. I don't see why other countries should either. And again, I think that international cooperation should be the order of the day in a global pandemic.
Mal?
Lisa, you say we've been spending too much on defense, but Where would you specifically cut military spending? What programs do you see as not being needed?
Well, I definitely don't think we need 800 bases, or, you know, it's a hard number to quantify. Actually, there are many small. Africa is now full of U.S. military installations. Asia has been, Eurasia has been for a long, long time. I would close those for starters. I think that the essentially the personnel costs of our military are not the biggest issue for me personally. Depending on what people in our armed services are tasked with doing, they could be very helpful in a global pandemic or in a climate crisis. I know the Canadian Defense Forces are training to respond to people that are being flooded out or burned out and so forth. So, that could be a direction for the many people who are employed by the Department of Defense. But the reason that the price tag is so big for our Pentagon is that much of it is corporate welfare. And by that, I mean giving already very wealthy corporations such as General Dynamics, one of the biggest multinational weapons manufacturers in the world, huge contracts. So that they become so wealthy, they buy back their own stocks with their profits. They pay their CEO $20 million a year before bonus. And those costs are either borne by the taxpayer or, even worse, we borrow to fund those costs, and future generations of taxpayers have to pay for it.
I'm going to go to some of the voicemails that came in before this program. We'll start with Amanda.
Hi, my name is Amanda, and I'm calling from Portland. I wanted to ask Lisa Savage why she thinks that Medicare for All is important to have rather than just a single-payer healthcare system. Thank you so much.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for that question, Amanda. Medicare for All is an insurance scheme, way of funding universal health care, but it makes the government, the federal government, would be the single payer. There are, of course, other national health care systems, universal health care systems, that are used in other countries. For instance, the United Kingdom has an actual national health service where the hospitals are owned by the government, the doctors are employed by the government. Under Medicare for All, that would not be the case. Medicare for All is, in my mind, a very good way to respond to a healthcare emergency that has been unfolding even before the pandemic, but certainly has accelerated during this time, because every doctor in the U.S. already has a Medicare number, and most of the people who would receive Medicare for All already have a Social Security number. So it would not be a matter of, you know, shutting down hospitals and reopening them as government entities. It would be a matter of the federal government providing the reimbursement to hospitals, doctors, pharmaceuticals, and the federal government would have the power to negotiate with Big Pharma to keep the price of, unnecessary drugs down, which other countries do. People in other countries cannot believe what Americans have to pay for medications, procedures. When they're abroad, if they get hurt or have to find a medicine, they're always amazed, like, it's so affordable. What's going on with our country? We need to get the for-profit out of healthcare. I don't believe the words profit and healthcare really belong in the same sentence together. Not every human endeavor is appropriate as a profit-making endeavor. And really, that is what has driven the really, really high cost of healthcare in our country with low health incomes. We have a terrible infant mortality rate compared with other wealthy nations. We have a terrible maternal mortality rate compared with other nations. It's getting that profit motive out of healthcare. Should not be a commodity. It should be a human right. And even countries that aren't very wealthy have universal health care. So I'm quite sure that the U.S. can achieve that goal.
Mal?
One of the big concerns about that particular approach, of course, is the cost. How do you pay for it? I mean, the current system has its premiums that the private insurance companies are charging. And even under Medicare, there are charges that are there for consumers on copays and other various charges. So it's not like it's, one free piece of health care from one payment. there's all sorts of other things involved here. How do you move out of that complexity to something as simple as you're talking about?
Yes, thanks for that question. It's a good point. I'm in favor of improved and expanded Medicare for All. And by improved, I mean right now we have sort of body parts Medicare, meaning it doesn't cover dental, it doesn't cover mental health or vision or hearing. So people on Medicare have to buy supplemental insurance from a private health insurer to cover those. I would do away with all that. It really needs to cover the whole person and all of their health needs. But as far as how to pay for it, oddly enough, the public outlay of funds for our current healthcare system, which is a patchwork of private and public, is already commensurate on a per capita outlay, is already commensurate with other wealthy nations that have single payer. We did a webinar on Medicare for All. My campaign did an informational webinar, and we had a representative from Physicians for National Healthcare, Dr. Margaret Flowers, who has spent many years researching and organizing to get public single-payer health care. And she showed us a chart that showed the public is already outlaying as much money as other countries do. And she said, we're already paying for public health care. We're just not getting it. Then there was another whole additional private outlay of funds in, beyond what the public is paying for that was built into that cost. So I believe that we can afford it. We do need to restructure it so it covers everything. And, all the other countries did it after World War II. They still have it. I don't know what makes us think that the U.S. is so exceptional that it can't have universal health care.
All right. Well, we're going to go to another voicemail. This is from Chris.
Hi, this is Chris. I'm calling from Scarborough. What do the candidates intend to do to prevent Russia from further interfering in American politics or the American electoral process? Thank you.
Lisa?
Well, I don't think that Russia interfering in our elections is a big issue for me. I think that our elections are interfered with internally far more than any, information that may have originated from Russia and come to us through social media and other ways. We see voter suppression in many, many places in the United States. We see people of color being disenfranchised widely in certain states. I'm very proud to live in Maine. I think that we have a great reputation for electoral integrity here in Maine. But I think that the big problem with U.S. elections would be throwing people off the voter rolls, closing down polling places. And I, again, would look to our own backyard and fix things here before I would worry too much about Russia.
Mal?
But if you look at what's happened in other countries, you've had elections influenced by not just Russia. We shouldn't pick on the Russian Federation. It's also been China. It's been Iran. There's been a lot of countries trying to influence through creating these negative approaches. The most recent one was this website that looked like a news website that spent all its time attacking Joe Biden. So how do you deal with that? I mean, you're saying you don't think it's a big issue here in Maine. There would be folks in the intelligence community that would argue with you about that.
Well, I'm sure there are folks in the intelligence community that would argue with me about several things. Certainly, I'm not saying there aren't deliberate disinformation campaigns out there. There certainly are. As we all know, as consumers of, digital information, things are not always as they appear. And as a teacher, I spent many years teaching secondary students how to really analyze what they're seeing online and realizing that just because it's on the internet doesn't make it true. But I would return to if you wanted to have a contest about which country has interfered the most in other countries' elections, even going so far as to violently overturn democratically elected leaders, I think the U.S. would win that contest. It doesn't mean it's okay to interfere with our elections either, but I do think that, before pointing the finger at other actors, it might be a good job for the U.S. to look within and say, have we done this to other countries? I'm pretty sure we've been doing it for decades to other countries, and a lot of people have died and suffered as a result of our violent overthrow of governments that wanted to control their own resources, and the U.S. corporations that were doing business there didn't want that to happen. So, I think whether we can rely on information being true and authentic online is a big problem. It's an election problem, and it's an education problem, and in general, it's a problem for our modern 21st century world. I would point to the COVID epidemic as a key place where information about a scientific phenomenon has become politicized, and people are sincerely confused about what to think. Does wearing a mask increase the safety of people you're around? Does it increase your own safety? You know, how safe is it to go to a wedding? The information about that simple of things that are very high stakes right now has been filled with confusion and misinformation and highly politicized. It's a modern problem for sure.
We are going to take another quick break. We're speaking with U.S. Senate candidate Lisa Savage. If you're quick, you can get a question in by email, tweet, or Facebook. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet@mainepublic, or go on today's Facebook page and leave a comment. We just have a few minutes left in the program. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling, with help from the law offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com. MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management, and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy. And AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots. aarp.org/mainevotes.
Carlton Wiley of Cherryfield pitched a perfect inning in the 1958 World Series for the Milwaukee Braves against the New York Yankees on October 6, 1958. Wiley was called to keep the Yankees in check during the eighth inning of the pivotal fifth game of the series. It was the biggest game of Wiley's life, and the slim right-hander from Cherryfield knew it. "I felt pretty weak walking in there," he said. "Geez, I thought I was walking on my knees." But a fellow Mainer, a young man who told Wiley he was from Blue Hill, approached him from the stands while he was warming up and made him feel right at home.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Tanya Mosley. Migrant farm workers already have difficult and strenuous jobs, but this year is even more challenging with the pandemic and wildfires raging.
Farm workers feed us through their labor. They pick, pack, and plant the food that we eat. They are essential workers.
That story and the latest on the president's health, next time on Here and Now.
And Here and Now is coming up next at noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Maine Public's senior political correspondent, Mal Leary, is on the line with us as well. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2020 discussion with Lisa Savage. She is running as an independent for U.S. Senate. We invite you to send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to another voicemail now that came in before the program. This is Barbara.
My name is Barbara, and I live in Portland, and I'd like to ask the candidates if they would initiate or support a ban on military-style weapons. Thank you.
Yes, I do favor a ban on assault weapons. Sometimes it's hard to get the definitions exactly right about what are we talking about when we say military-style weapons. My definition of assault weapons is weapons that are designed to kill many people quickly. I don't like guns personally, but I'm married to a hunter. He's a responsible gun owner. He takes our grandson hunting, and most of my neighbors around me in Solon, Maine, where I live, are responsible gun owners. So I do respect their rights and the fact that, you know, most constituents in Maine don't want to see a complete ban on gun ownership. However, I've also listened to second graders planning how they would escape and keep themselves safe when an active shooter came to our school. They had a door they were going to run out of and a neighbor that they were going to take refuge with. I don't think second graders should be worried about that sort of thing. So I think that we need to find a balance where we recognize that, you know, the Second Amendment, when it provided for a well-ordered militia, was not talking about individuals who have armories of, you know, assault weapons and then, you know, go out and kill many, many, many people in a short amount of time. So I hope that answers Barbara's question.
Mal.
Would you look at that whole question? As you point out, it's very difficult. You know, for example, one weapon that's often called an assault weapon, the AR-15, can also be used for hunting. It is used by some folks for hunting. How do you differentiate, you know, that sort of, if you will, dual-purpose weapon? I mean, in its military form, it certainly meets your definition, but it also could be used for hunting.
Right. Well, again, I would go back to, is it designed to, you know, if someone's hunting, they're not trying to kill 15 deer in 5 minutes, because obviously they can't tag 15 deer. So I would again return to, is it designed for hunting or is it designed for killing lots of humans quickly? Obviously, it's a case-by-case basis, and I believe that the AR-15 is not designed for killing multiple people quickly, but I'd have to do some research on that to be sure.
Lisa, I'm going to go to a question. We have a few of these. This one is Robin on Facebook. She says, it's a bit ironic that most people I've spoken with who support Lisa Savage say their number one issue is health care. But if she is a spoiler and enables Collins to win, then the Republicans will have the votes in the Senate they need to completely take affordable health care away. Other questions, this whole idea that just because it's ranked choice voting doesn't mean you can't be a spoiler. Somebody else asking, explain to me why I don't need to worry. Explain this to our emailers and our Facebook posters.
Well, I think I already answered this question, but I'll take another crack at it. I could refer people to my website. It's lisaformaine.org. We have a whole section on ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting is, you know, still relatively new, so we're getting used to it. Places like Australia have had it since 1947. My team did some research and found academics in Australia that have studied ranked choice voting in state level, and that would be called provincial in Australia elections, and kind of looked at this issue. The real reason that ranked choice voting is so appealing to people is it eliminates the spoiler problem. So you can vote your values without fear, and you can make your safety choice as your second ranking. And, you know, I don't think your health care problems are going to be solved by the Democrats either. They don't support universal health care, and their platform is, both Sarah Gideon and Joe Biden's platform is making the so-called Unaffordable Care Act more affordable. The people that live around where I've been teaching school for 25 years, it doesn't matter how they cannot afford the, you know, the Health Care Act as it is. Having the profit motive in health care makes it unaffordable for low-income and working-class people in Maine. So, but the spoiler issue, you know, I would just urge people to get more education about ranked choice voting. I would also remind them, okay, I live in the 2nd District. We had Bruce Poliquin as our representative. He was an unpopular incumbent. He didn't hold town halls. He ran away from constituents and journalists. Was not a popular guy. Jared Golden was running against him. Jared Golden was serving in the Maine legislature, but he's relatively young and not a lot of name recognition. People didn't know a lot about Jared Golden going into that election, I would argue. There were two independents in that race. At the end of the first round, Bruce Poliquin was ahead. he had polled the highest. However, he did not reach a majority. So as when the, instant runoff kicked in and they, struck the independent off the bottom of the ballot and said, okay, people that picked that candidate first, who did they rank second? And they transferred those votes to the other candidates. That's why Jared Golden took that seat. So I think that that's, a good object lesson to remember when we're thinking about how can ranked choice voting affect the outcome of an election.
Tim on Facebook asks, does Lisa support ending cash bail and making major overhauls to the broken justice system?
Yes, I do. Thank you for that question, Tim. I think cash bail is basically penalizes people for being poor. I know that most people that are in jail in Maine, in prisons and jails, are in there because they could not make bail or they could not pay fines that were due. It's very, very hard on their families when this happens. Again, from the teacher point of view, it's devastating to children when their parent is jailed, especially if that parent was the breadwinner for the family. And, we can deal with low-level offenses and the inability to pay fines and so forth by other methods than jailing people. We definitely have an incarceration nation going. It affects people of color, black, indigenous, and other people of color way disproportionate to the rate of their criminal activity, which is, no worse than white people's, but they're jailed much, much more. And, it increases a family's poverty when someone in the family must be in jail because they can't pay a fine or they can't make bail. We really could do a much better job in our criminal justice system of referring people to resources that would help them. And even especially in the pandemic, it's been pretty amazing to me how Maine has clung to keeping people incarcerated who are not a threat to society. The majority of people that are in Maine jails have been convicted of nothing. They are awaiting trial, yet where they're being kept in a situation that's known to be high risk for COVID infection.
An email from Chris. So very impressed with your realistic good sense about nearly every question save one. You do not support the power line from Quebec. Do you realize that if the power, if imported, will displace 3 million tons of carbon dioxide that is from excess capacity and not from new dams or reservoirs in Quebec? Never mind obscene profits. Climate mitigation will need every way of reducing carbon emissions to hold back temperature increase.
Yes, unfortunately, Chris, the greenhouse gas emissions of the mega dams that generate this hydropower are far worse than actually coal or gas-fired plants. And don't take my word for it. I'm not a climate scientist, but MIT professor Dr. Brad Hager is someone who testified at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer hearing on the CMP corridor, and I had an opportunity later on to listen to him speak and talk to him in Mercer, where he is from. And he studied the greenhouse gas emissions, not just carbon, but greenhouse gas emissions of all the different ways of generating electricity, and showed that mega dams are actually far worse than the next worst kind because they produce a huge amount of methane when they drown areas the size of the state of Vermont and kill all the vegetation in that area by submerging it in water. The methane produced is a much more harmful greenhouse gas than carbon is. So actually, the greenhouse gas footprint of a megadam is terrible. That's before you get to how many carbon sequestering trees will we cut down in the Maine woods to run the power line through. This is a time in human history where we should be planting trees, not cutting them down. And then the purpose is to run it to hook up with a line that could then sell that power to Massachusetts. My friends in Massachusetts tell me, oh, we were sold this as clean energy. We had no idea what the reality was, and it passed quickly because Massachusetts had set these very ambitious goals about reducing their carbon you know. So I think it's a bad deal on both ends and in the middle, and it's been really surprising to me how many of Maine's elected officials and candidates don't realize that this is, I think, it's the most broadly opposed project that I've seen that I can remember in Maine. No, you know, people of all political persuasions, real Mainers, are against the CMP corridor project.
Mal, I think we might have room for one more question.
Well, to follow up on that, Lisa, the issue is one of also a balancing between state regulation and federal regulation. What role do you think the federal government should have in regulating such transmission lines, which, of course, is the area you'd be operating in were you successful in your election?
Well, it is an international transmission line, actually, Mal, so that's a good point. What role do I think the federal government should have in regulating international energy projects? Probably a pretty strong role, since the state of Maine is not really in a position to, you know, negotiate strongly with Canada as an entity. Is that enough of an answer to your question?
I think for what Jennifer is saying, it probably is. We're just about out of time.
Well, we do have about a minute left. I'll see if I can go to a quick question from one of our audience members. This is an email from Arthur. I appreciate your stance of not taking big money from corporations or PACs, but this leaves you with much less funding than the two candidates who appear to be holding the majority of the votes. Is this a winning strategy for you? In any case, why are you taking this position? And about a minute and a half.
Because my purpose is to go to the U.S. Senate as a voice for Maine's working people. I don't think that millionaires can do a good job of understanding what people in Maine are struggling with and what their needs are. I do think that we've raised enough money to get our name out there and do some, you know, do the basic campaign. We have a huge amount of grassroots support. We have a great group of volunteers that just give us their time and do a great job for us. So, you know, we have paid staff. We have bought more advertising recently than we have in the past, and we've done the best we could to raise money from grassroots donations so that we're not beholden. I have no experience taking money from corporate lobbyists and writing legislation to benefit those corporations. If the people of Maine want a senator like that, then I'm their candidate. I'm the only non-millionaire in the race.
All right. Well, Lisa Savage, thank you so much for your time today. Lisa Savage is running as an independent for U.S. Senate. And thank you, Mal, for joining me today for this hour. We will hear from you tomorrow, because tomorrow we continue our series of Your Vote 2020 candidate interviews. Mal and I will be speaking with independent Max Lynn. We welcome your questions in advance via voicemail. Again, 207-370-3487. Leave your first name, where you live, and then your question or comment. And don't forget about our new time, 11 in the morning. Today's sound engineer, Lucy Suchek. This program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. And you can visit our website, mainecalling.org, for links to past programs and resources mentioned, as well as the Your Vote 2020 website with all sorts of information about the 2020 campaign. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.